At the very outset, you will understand that I'll be speaking with a bias, and so you are to interpret all of my thoughts in that light. I submit to you that bias is a good word. Prejudice is a bad word. Bias is a good word. Prejudice is to prejudge. Bias can come from an honest evaluation of the facts as they really exist. Let me suggest to you further that you are getting a distorted presentation of the facts as they are occurring relative to the Middle East in the media of the United States of the present hour. I do not pretend to know why or what is behind it, whether Al Haig, who cannot endorse the present policy that we seem to be moving toward, knowing what was going to be happening, felt he had to get out, or whether there is some kind of pressure being brought on the media, or whether or not this is just a reflection of a liberal media in this country, I do not know. But of this I am convinced, that we are getting a distorted picture of the facts, particularly in recent days. Sometimes those who are covering the story just are not aware of the facts as they really are. They're getting facts perhaps from the PLO, as a lot of the media has, misrepresented facts that they're anxious to publish. Almost invariably, they're presenting situations out of the context in which they developed. And as a result, the Middle East has dominated the news, and yet the average American has no idea what is really happening, doesn't even have a definition for a lot of the terms. And so we're going to try to give you an overview of the facts as best we can, and I hope it'll be helpful to you from a Christian biblical standpoint. Let me begin then with the year 1897, and I will of necessity be going quickly. Some of these things, a few chapters, will deal with some of these things in the book, Not Without Design, which some of you have purchased. 1897 is a good starting date because that's when you had the first Zionist Congress. Some Jewish leaders met with a view to discussing the possibility of the establishment of a homeland for the Jew in Palestine. The year was 1897. The luminary figure was Theodor Herzl. In a word, out of that first Zionist Congress in 1897, there came one overriding feeling, that is, that they wanted to seek to establish a homeland in Palestine for the Jew, and they did not want to do it through revolution. They wanted to do it through the approval of major world powers, diplomatically, not through revolution. That was 1897. 1917 is the next date I want to bring to your attention. This is at the end of the First World War. At the end of the First World War, Great Britain, then one of the most powerful nations on the face of the earth, came out with what is known as the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration became the foundation for much of the decision-making relative to the establishment of a Jewish state. In 1917, Great Britain said, "His Majesty's government looks with favor upon the establishment of a homeland in Palestine for the Jew." Now remember, in 1897, the goal of the Zionist Congress was that major powers would establish a homeland for the Jew. In 1917, Great Britain, then one of the most powerful nations in the world, said, "His Majesty's government looks with favor upon the establishment of a homeland in Palestine for the Jew." What is important about this is that Palestine was under British control. The British captured Palestine during the First World War. Now, they did not capture it from the Palestinians. There has never been a Palestinian state. That is a propaganda ploy that began in 1967 after the Palestinians were driven, some of them, from the West Bank. But there has never been a Palestinian state. The area we know as Palestine today was controlled by the Ottoman Empire. The Turks controlled Palestine for centuries. And they captured it from the Mamluks. They captured it from the Crusaders. And they captured it from the Muslims. And they captured it from Rome, and they captured it from Israel. There was never a Palestinian state, and Jews have always, since the time of Christ, resided in Israel. There has always been a Jewish population there. The word Palestinian referred to either Jew or Arab. Didn't matter. Anybody who lived in that geographical location was called a Palestinian. Jews were Palestinians up until 1948 and the formation of the Jewish state. Now, Great Britain captured the area we know as Palestine from the Turks in 1917 during the First World War. And it was Great Britain that established the nation we know as Jordan. Jordan is not an ancient land. Jordan is a modern, young nation. As a matter of fact, about 80% of what had historically been known as Palestine was given by the British to establish the nation that we today know as Jordan. They did that because during the First World War, there were some Arab leaders, who fought on the side of the British against Germany. And as a reward for that, they established the nation we know as Jordan. As a matter of fact, it was given to King Hussein's grandfather. And so 80% of what was historically Palestine became the Jordanian state, and most of the citizens of Jordan are Palestinians. Okay, that happened in 1917. In 1922, the League of Nations was formed. The League of Nations was the forerunner to the United Nations. It was a worldwide body. And in 1922, the League of Nations gave to Great Britain a mandate that Great Britain establish a homeland in Palestine for the Jew. Now note then, in 1897, the First Zionist Congress said, we desire to establish a homeland in Palestine for the Jew, recognized by major world powers. In 1917, Great Britain, which controlled Palestine, said, we would like to establish a homeland for the Jew, 1917. In 1922, then, the League of Nations came along and said, okay, we're giving a mandate to Great Britain, which controlled Palestine, to establish a homeland in Palestine for the Jew. But the British government changed, political realities changed, and that homeland for the Jew was not established. By the time you reach 1933, 34, 35, Adolf Hitler is beginning his ascendancy to power in Germany. He's beginning to march through Europe. He's beginning to persecute the Jew. Slow at first, and increasingly it would get more severe until you would have the death camps and the concentration camps. And in the 1930s, the mid-1930s, 35, 36, 37, the Jews began to flee, first from Germany and then from the nations in Europe where the German troops were marching as they tried to get away from Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. They tried to flee to Australia, and Australia said, sorry, we have our immigration quotas. Only so many people from that area of the world can come. They tried to go to Canada, said the same thing. Tried to come to the United States. They said the same thing. We have our immigration quotas. Now you must visualize the historical context. Jews were literally fleeing for their lives with nothing but the clothing on their backs. They were trying to get into major nations of the world, and those nations of the world had, for all practical purposes, closed their borders. And so many of them would try to get into Israel. Any way they possibly could, they would try to get into the land of Israel. And in 1938, at almost the peak of this, Great Britain came out with what was known as the White Papers. The White Papers was an official document which restricted Jewish emigration into Israel to 1,500 people a month. Now that was less than a drop in the ocean in the context of Jews who were fleeing Adolf Hitler, could not get into any nations of the world, and one of the places they were trying to get in to escape for their lives was Israel. And at that moment, Great Britain said only 1,500 a month. Now, why did Great Britain say that? Was she a heartless nation that just wanted to be vindictive? No. During the First World War, the surrounding Arab nations had fought with the British, Lawrence of Arabia. Now, by the time you reach 1938, it is obvious, the handwriting is on the wall, that the prospects for a second world war were great. And Great Britain was influential in that part of the world and very concerned that if or when another war breaks out, the surrounding Arab nations would again, like they did in the First World War, fight alongside of the British. And so when they began to complain that Jews were entering the land of Israel or Palestine, they put pressure on the British, who are very sensitive now, so they passed the white papers that saying Jewish emigration, only 1,500 people a month, which was almost nothing. Now, the present Prime Minister of Israel is Menachem Begin. And Menachem Begin had established the Irgun, which was an underground army. And that underground army began to fight the British. And so he was called, when he came into office, a terrorist. Well, why was he fighting the British? Because here were Jews, see the context, here were Jews who were fleeing Adolf Hitler and the Nazis for their very life. They could not get into most of the nations of the world, so they were trying any way they could to get into Israel. And in the midst of this situation, Great Britain says only 1,500 a month. Menachem Begin began to fight the British only in the sense that he was trying to get these fleeing Jews into Israel, and the British were trying to keep them out. One of the tragedies of history is that it is invariably written by those who are triumphant. If you were to go to Great Britain and read the history of our War of Independence, you'll find their history books are a lot different than ours, because they write it from their frame of reference and we write it from ours. And if we had lost, it would have been another story. But now Menachem Begin was trying, and I'm not endorsing Menachem Begin, he did some terrible things. But you will understand that he was fighting the British only in the sense that he was trying to bring these Jews who were fleeing for their lives into Israel. The Second World War broke out. The Jews said, we've got a far greater danger, a far worse enemy, and they joined the Allies in fighting Hitler during the Second World War. During the Second World War, 6 million Jews perished. You can debate whether it was 5.5 or 6 million, but between 5.5 and 6 million Jewish people perished under the Holocaust. Those who survived, they had lost their mothers, their fathers, their sisters, their brothers, relatives all over the place. If you get our magazine, Israel My Glory, and you read reports from Joel of Jerusalem, or you read his life story in the book Zvi, you will know that he lost his whole family. Mother, father, brother, sister, he was the only survivor in his family. My predecessor, director of the Friends of Israel, lost his entire family during the Holocaust. And the only reason he survived was in the providence and sovereignty of God, when he proposed to his wife, who was British. She said, I'll marry you, but not if we're going to go back to Poland, if you will stay here and do missionary work amongst the Jewish people in Britain. And so, under that arrangement, he was in Britain and was miraculously preserved, survived. His family all got killed off. Well, about 5.5 or 6 million Jewish people perished. Those who survived, what were you going to do after the Second World War? Your parents were killed, your brothers, your sisters, most of your relatives. Your home was perhaps destroyed or confiscated. Often you were turned into the Gestapo for a bottle of vodka. So what do you do? Well, for most Jews, it was try to get to Israel. Any possible way they could. In dilapidated, unseaworthy ships, they would leave ports of embarkation in Europe to cross the Mediterranean to get to Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. But there was the sophisticated British Navy. And oil was a factor. And there's only a small handful, relatively speaking, of Jews in Israel and the surrounding Arab nations. And they still didn't want the Jews coming back. And you still had the white papers restricting emigration to 1,500. And so the sophisticated British destroyers would wait until these Jewish vessels got within 3 miles of the land of Israel, and they would stop them. And they would then send them back to the port of embarkation wherever they had left in Europe. Or they would take them to the island of Cyprus. There they would intern them, and they would allow 1,500 a month to come from the island of Cyprus into Israel. Until one day they stopped a ship called the Exodus. And the Exodus was loaded with passengers. And the British Navy said, go back. And the commanding officer said, we're not going to go back. And the British Navy said, well, we're going to board you. And the captain of the Exodus said, if you board us, we're going to blow the ship up with men, women, and children, several thousand. And by now, the world's sympathy was there because the truths of the Holocaust was coming out. And so the British said, well, then we're just going to wait here until you leave. To which they responded, we're not going to leave and we're not going to eat. And as the men, women, and children, many of them already half dead, as they die of starvation, we're going to throw the bodies over the side for the world to see. Great Britain, frustrated, had more than 100,000 troops stationed in Israel. More than 100,000 troops. Absolutely frustrated, said, we cannot resolve this matter. And they went back to the United Nations and said, we cannot resolve this issue. We're giving it back to the United... The League of Nations gave it to us in 1922. Well, now we're giving it back to you. You take care of it. And within 10 years, Great Britain, one of the most powerful nations the world has ever known, went down the tubes and became a third-class world power, morally, spiritually, economically, politically, militarily, a third-class world. You see, there's a principle. It's true of individuals, it's true of nations. Those that bless thee, I will bless. Those that curse thee, I will curse. They had a moral and a legal obligation to establish a homeland for the Jew, but because of political expediency, they did not do it. They turned it over to the United Nations and they went down the tubes. As Great Britain pulled out of Palestine over a six-month period after they turned it over to the United Nations, as they pulled out very unevenly. That is, they favored the Arabs, and in every way they could, they harassed the Jewish population. They would launch surprise attacks and raids, and they would come into the communal farms, the kibbutz, and they would confiscate all of the military equipment they could find and take it away from them. And this went on for about the 6 months before their actual pullout. And as they turned it over to the United Nations voted to partition Palestine. Now, you will understand that 80% of what was historically Palestine was already given over to Jordan and, in large measure, was a Palestinian state, 80%. There was 20% left. They said, okay, now we've got 20% left, far less than what had been promised to Israel in the mandate of the League of Nations and promised by Great Britain, far less. They said, okay, we've got 20% left in Palestine. We're going to cut that in half. We'll give half to the Jews for a Jewish state and half for a Palestinian state. And so they divided what was left, the 20%. Now Israel, with great reluctance, because it was only a small fraction of what she'd been promised, said, well, it's better than nothing, we'll accept it. The Palestinians said, we're not satisfied. Now on May 14th, 1948, in Tel Aviv, Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, stood up and he declared Israel a nation among the nations of the world. The surrounding Arab nations had said, if you declare yourself a nation, we will drive you into the Mediterranean Sea in 1 week. Citizens of Israel, Jewish citizens, 620,000. Arabs and surrounding Arab nations, about 80 million. It's ironic. Who was fighting who? Who was attacking whom? 80,620,000. And I remind you that the United Nations, a world body, had partitioned Palestine, and it had belonged to Britain. It was not a Palestinian state. Jews and Arabs lived there. And now it was partitioned, so there was a little part given for a Jewish state in 1948. The surrounding Arab nations said, if you declare yourself a nation, we will drive you into the Mediterranean Sea in 1 week. On May 14th, 1948, Ben-Gurion stood up and he declared Israel a nation among the nations of the world. Now, the surrounding Arab nations said to the Palestinian Arabs living in Israel, and in, you'll understand they were citizens, any Arab that had land that was living in the area that was allocated for a Jewish state was allowed to stay there. He was allowed to be a citizen, first-class citizen. He kept his land. He had his representatives in the Congress or the Knesset. He was a citizen of Israel, no problem. There are more than 1 million non-Jews who are citizens of Israel right now, just so we have proper perspective. They were there, and they spoke Hebrew in large measure, and the Jews who were there spoke Arabic. They'd been neighbors, many of them, for centuries. The surrounding Arab nations said, we're going to drive the Jews into the Mediterranean in 1 week. So you get out. Get out of the way. And after we destroy them, you could go back and you can have your property and you can have your neighbor's property too. The Jews did not drive them out. They did not threaten them. They did not intimidate them. As a matter of fact, there's overwhelming evidence that they pled with them to stay. Of their own volition, Arab Palestinians left the area of Israel and went into what we know today as the West Bank. That was part of the area that was allocated for a Palestinian state. A strip of land, approximately 100 miles long, 20 miles wide, starting about 15 miles south of the Sea of Galilee and going down to about the middle of the Dead Sea. It's called the West Bank because it is on the western side of the Jordan River. So they call it the West Bank. Biblically, it was Judea, Samaria. That was the West Bank. So the Arabs in the Jewish area, many of them, not all of them, left and went into the West Bank and thought, we'll wait here a week. The Arab nations will come through and drive the Jews into the Mediterranean. Then we can go back and have our land and theirs. Problem was, it didn't happen that way. Now, Israel knew she was going to be attacked. She knew that she was on the verge of war, and so they sent Golda Meir to the United States. Golda Meir would be a prime minister of Israel later. She was born in Russia. She was brought, however, to the United States as a young girl, and she lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Golda Meir went to public school in Milwaukee. She went to college in Milwaukee, and she taught public school as an American citizen in Milwaukee. But then as a young woman, she became a Zionist, believed in the reality of a homeland for the Jew, and so she went back to Israel, got involved in politics in Israel, and now when Israel knew she was going to be attacked, they had no money. They didn't have a government, they didn't have a treasury, they didn't have, to speak of, an official army, they didn't have any equipment, and they knew they were going to be attacked. Well, they needed money to get weapons. They sent agents out. They found some countries that would sell them old, dilapidated, pre-First World War weapons. But they didn't even have the money to buy it. So they sent Golda Meir to the United States, hoping maybe she could tell the Jewish community and others who were interested and sympathetic about the Jewish plight, and maybe she could raise $10, $12 million in a couple of months. She got off the plane in New York, and the first day out, they had arranged a meeting for her, and I don't remember the figure, it's in the book, I think, $15 or $30 million, some fantastic sum, first meeting. And she raised something like $60 million in a matter of a few weeks. And with this money, word went out to Israeli agents all over the world to buy whatever kind of equipment you can get. Well, on May 14th, Israel declared herself a nation. Perhaps the thing that she needed more than anything else at that moment was that she be recognized as a political entity by the nations of the world. It's one thing to be a nation on paper. It's another thing to be a nation in reality. The United Nations had partitioned Palestine, but the surrounding Arab nations said, we're going to drive in the Mediterranean. Israel needed political recognition from other nations of the world, world powers. It was imperative if she was going to survive. Harry Truman was president of the United States at the time, and our State Department came to Harry Truman, and they said, you cannot recognize Israel. Many of our generals, the Pentagon, said to Harry Truman, you cannot recognize Israel. It wasn't that they weren't sympathetic, but the realities of the moment said, look, Israel doesn't have a chance. It's very likely that she's going to be stillborn. Six Arab nations are going to attack, and she's going to be driven right off the map, and if we recognize her, and a week later she doesn't exist, we'll have made a diplomatic blunder. Can't recognize Israel. He was leaning in that direction to follow that advice. But before Harry Truman had become president of the United States, he'd been a haberdasher. He had a men's store, and he had a partner. And in the sovereignty of God, that partner was Jewish. And that partner got on a plane from Missouri and flew up to Washington, D.C. to visit his old friend Harry. He went into the presence of the President of the United States, and he pled with Harry Truman to give his people a chance. And it's an amazing thing. God has blessed this nation as no other nation. I don't know if you really think about it. as no other nation in human history. I mean, we complain about inflation, and we complain about unemployment, and we complain about a lot of other things, while most Americans have got two cars, and many have a cabin, and many have a trailer, and many have a boat, and we don't know what it is to have it tough yet. It'll come, but not yet. But God has blessed this country, as He has never blessed any country on the face of the earth, for two primary reasons. Because from the shores of the United States, missionaries have been sent out to the farthest corner of the earth. And two, if you know history, the United States gave to the Jew a homeland as no other nation in the world did. Great Britain went against her moral obligation and went down the tubes. The United States, under President Harry Truman, whatever you may think of him, good or bad, had a little sign on his desk, "The buck stops here." And he went against our State Department, and many of our generals went out on a limb, and he recognized the State of Israel. We have been the recipients of blessing that we won't know till we get to heaven because of that. But never mind. It was critical for her existence that she be recognized as a nation by some of the major nations, and America came and did it. Now, on September 15th, six Arab nations, the day after Israel declared herself a nation, she was attacked by six nations. Egypt was among them. Egypt sent an armada of ships along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea and stood off the shores at Tel Aviv, Israel's largest city. Excuse me, Israel had no artillery, had no planes, had no ships, was at the mercy of this artillery barrage, which would level Tel Aviv. In desperation, she located a little Piper Cub, little two-man plane. A young man got in to pilot, another man got in to be the bombardier. This plane repeatedly made low passes over this armada of ships by Egypt. The bombardier had handmade bombs. Open the cockpit, and with the hands he would throw them out. Finally, in desperation, flew very low, threw one of the bombs out, and it hit the largest ship in this armada. The entire armada of Egyptian ships turned around and went back. And in that last pass, the plane flew so low that the plane crashed and the two young men perished. One of them, one of the fathers of these two men, would become the first speaker of the Israeli Knesset. The other would be involved in the deciphering of the Dead Sea Scrolls, as God would have it. Egypt sent a strong military force north through the Sinai. It was to be a two-pronged attack. They were to divide up. One of the prongs was to attack Jerusalem, where the Jewish people were, in the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem. And the other was to go along the coast to Tel Aviv and to link up later with Iraqi and Syrian troops. To go through the Sinai, there was a Jewish communal farm, a kibbutz, in the Sinai. And the Egyptian force was going to have to pass through that way, and they knew it. And so the farmers sent their wives and their children back. They were joined with 70 of the Israeli soldiers, had about 150 men. They had, I think, two doctors, four nurses, four automatic weapons, one rocket launcher that could knock out a tank with two or four shells. They dug into the sands of the Sinai. They had a concrete tank that could hold water. They would be reinforced by a little plane that would fly low over at night and drop some food, some supplies. The Egyptian force came, had tanks, had half tracks, had air cover with a couple of Messerschmitt planes. That 150-man force held back about 2,500 Egyptians for 6 months. And as they were holding them, I'm giving you facts now, as they were holding them back, the money that Golda Meir had got when she came to the United States had now gone to buy equipment, and some of that equipment now began to arrive. And one of the things that arrived was four-wheel Jeeps. Moshe Dayan, who died about 4 months ago, the one who had the patch, chief of staff, he had been an officer in the British Army. He took those Jeeps, mounted machine guns on those Jeeps, took some Israeli soldiers, went into the desert, and took on the advancing Egyptian troops and defeated them, and they returned. In the north, in the Galilee, Iraq and Syrian troops had banded together. their responsibility in this six-nation carefully coordinated attack was to capture the Galilee. And then having captured the Galilee in the north, they were to cut across to Haifa and cut Israel in half. To capture the Galilee, they had to capture the city of Tiberias on the very shores of the Sea of Galilee. And there was only one obstacle, a little kibbutz, a communal farm called Degania, which was on the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. And they had to knock out this farm community. And so they came with tanks, with troops, with automatic weapons. The defenders had almost nothing. No anti-tank equipment, no mines, no rocket launchers, no bazookas, no heavy artillery. They couldn't stop the tanks, and the tanks broke through the barbed wire that they had put around this communal farm. They were about to give up, and the oldest man pled with the men to fight on. As the tanks came through the barbed wire, there were two youngsters, a 14 and a 15-year-old girl and boy, hiding in the underbrush. And as the tanks came by, these two youngsters had made Molotov cocktails, handmade bombs. And as the tanks broke through the barbed wire, these two youngsters climbed on the back of tanks. They got one Molotov cocktail in and destroyed one tank and badly burned and damaged another. And the entire attacking force of Syrian Iraqi troops turned around and left. I'm saying these are just a few of so many things I could tell you. He who hath an ear to hear, the sovereign, miraculous working of God behind all of this, so that when you reach the ceasefire in 1949, not only had Israel survived, but she had actually captured some of the Arab territory by the time they reached the ceasefire. But now you had these Arabs who had lived inside of Israel, who on their own volition had left and settled on the West Bank. Now you would say, well, the 80 million plus Arabs and the Arab nations could easily absorb this, maybe 600,000. But they chose not to. They chose not to absorb them, not to allow them in, not to give them any aid deliberately. They kept them impoverished in housing that was mud huts worse than pigsties. Deliberately. Saudi Arabia in the last 18 months has given more than $30 billion to Iraq in its war with Iran, but gave not one penny for some of their own people who are living in absolute poverty in mud huts. Not one Arab nation would give them a dime, nor even allow them in. Not even Jordan, which was part of historic Palestine and made up of mostly Palestinians. Rather, they kept them there, designedly so, to show the world what these Zionist imperialists, these Jews, have done to their poor people, destroyed a nation. For 19 years, they were fed and clothed by the United Nations, about 90% of which was paid for by the United States. And the Arab nations didn't give one dime. Deliberately kept them there to be able to say, look at what the Jews have done to these poor Palestinians, who left of their own choice because the Arab nation said, get out, we're going to destroy the Jews. That's what happened in 48. That's the War of Independence. You had another war in 1956. This time, Nasser decided we're going to strangle Israel economically, and so he closed off the Suez Canal. Closed it off to Israeli shipping. It would have destroyed her economically. Once again, they said, okay, Moshe Dayan, go get them. They gave him some tanks, jeeps. He went into the Sinai, and that blockage was broken, and the day was saved. That was in 56. In 1967, Israel would go to war again. In the 1967 war, Israel would launch what is known as a preemptive strike. Israeli policy has been, continues to be, and will be a policy of preemptive strike. What do I mean by that? Israel says, our country is too small. Our bridge is too fragile. We are too narrow. Will you understand that what the United Nations gave to Israel to form a nation is less square footage than the state of New Jersey, and harder to defend because it was very narrow, at one point only 9 miles wide. And so Israel's policy from the day it became a nation is we cannot absorb a first strike attack. If we let Goliath hit us first, we're dead. And so the policy was, is, and will be preemptive. When we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that we are going to be attacked, we must hit first. If we don't hit first, we're done. We cannot absorb a first strike. In 1967, Israel knew. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, nobody has questioned it, nobody has debated it, nobody has argued against it, Israel knew. Israel has an intelligence gathering community which is known as the Mossad, like our CIA. It is considered by many to be the best intelligence gathering community in the world today. And incidentally, let me just digress for a moment and say, don't think that everything America has done for Israel has been strictly a one-way street. The Israeli intelligence gathering community, among the best in the world, has been and does feed espionage secrets that they get from the Soviet Union and other countries to the United States on an ongoing basis. And much of what we know is due to what we are getting from Israel. I would tell you further that probably Israel, more than any other source, has kept Russia out of the Middle East oil. Israel has had and has atomic capability, nuclear capability, and as I stand before you right now, has rockets with atomic warheads capable of reaching the Soviet Union, and probably the only nation on the earth that perhaps has the guts to use them if they had to. And the Soviet Union knows it, and while they could overwhelm Israel simply by size in probably a few days or weeks, they would pay a tremendous cost. And if she just went barreling into the Middle East and an attack on Israel, they know what would get. And you ought not to think that we have done everything for Israel and we have not been the recipient of anything on the other side. That simply is not true. As a matter of fact, the benefit that our military planners are getting from the capability of our equipment and the use of our equipment and tactics has been invaluable from Israel and what Israel has been doing. Now, we don't like to say that we wouldn't plan it that way, but the benefits have been incalculable to the United States. Now, in 1967, Israel knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Egypt and Syria were about to launch an attack. They knew it was coming. They knew where it was coming, when it was coming, how it was coming. And so Israel launched a preemptive strike. And among other things, sent its planes out to sea in a direction that could not be picked up by radar. Went way out to sea, came in from a direction that they never expected, came in dangerously and unbelievably low underneath the Russian-installed radar, and hit Egypt and Syria with most of her planes still on the ground with absolutely amazing accuracy, knocked out most of their air force in the first few hours of the war. That war was determined. The war continued for 6 days. While it was continuing, Nasser of Egypt called King Hussein of Jordan. And would you believe the Israelis actually intercepted and recorded the message? And in that message, Nasser said to King Hussein, he was lying through his teeth, "We are defeating the Israelis. We have their armies on their run. We are going to drive them into the Mediterranean Sea. And if you are not with us, you will be against us. We are going to toast our victory at the beaches of Tel Aviv. Are you with us or against us?" He was lying. They were being clobbered, but they wanted to get Jordan in to take some of the pressure off of them. And King Hussein, under intimidation by Nasser, committed his troops. I've had the privilege of having dinner in Jerusalem on any number of occasions and in New York by his invitation with General Uzi Narkis. General Narkis was the general in charge of the Central Theater of Operation. And he has shared with me many of the implications. He said, "Marvin, my troops were committed to a defensive posture. I was under orders that my troops were not to fire one round, not one shell, against the Jordanians. Mine was a holding posture outside of Jerusalem and along the West Bank." But through this phone call, King Hussein committed his troops and attacked. And it fell to Oxenarchus, who was in charge of the central theater operation, to counterattack. In the counterattack, he captured the city of Jerusalem, which was under Jordanian control, Kidron Valley, the Mount of Olives, and what you know as the West Bank. They got that from Jordan. In the south, they got the Sinai from Egypt, more than two times the whole size of the state of Israel. And in the north, from the Sea of Galilee, all the way north to Mount Hermon in modern-day Lebanon, they captured a mountain range called the Golan Heights, which was part of biblical Israel. The Golan Heights, a mountain range. Up there was one of the cities of refuge in Old Testament days. Now, from 1948 to 1967, the Syrians, with Russian advisors, planted miles of barbed wire and behind it, minefields. More miles of barbed wire and behind it, minefields, and a third strand of barbed wire. It was a Russian tactic. Three strands. Barbed wire, minefields, barbed wire, minefields, barbed wire. And interspersed all along more than 3 million mines along this mountain range. And interspersed were pillboxes. I've stood in them. If you go to Israel, a good tour, you'll get there along the Golan Heights. Pillboxes, more than 3 feet reinforced concrete with 3 to 4 feet of packed down dirt on top, stronger, better reinforced than any of the pillboxes during the Second World War. And up along this Golan Heights mountain range from 1948 to 67, below the mountain range was the Israeli farm communities, the kibbutz. And for 19 years, the Syrians would shell these Israeli farm communities. For 19 years, they'd shell them. The children lived underground in underground shelters. They went to school underground. They ate underground. Sometimes the children did not see the light of day for months at a time. And then they'd bring them out occasionally at night when there was a lull in the shelling to get some fresh air. For 19 years. But in 1967, Israel captured that Golan Heights mountain range. How'd they do it? They had a man by the name of Eli Cohen. If you go to Israel, you'll see Eli Cohen boulevards all over the place. Eli Cohen was a Jew born in Egypt, raised in Egypt. His mother tongue was Egyptian. His culture was Egyptian, Arabic. But he was a Jew who was now living in Israel. They trained him at the Israeli Mossad to be an agent. With falsified papers, they sent him to Argentina, Buenos Aires, because there were a lot of Syrian businessmen living in Buenos Aires. He went there with all kind of false papers, as though he was an Egyptian Arab. He began to meet all of the Syrians living there. He fronted as the exporter of fine furniture, got to know all of these men. After he was there for a year or two, with falsified papers, he now moved to Syria. Now many of the businessmen he had met in Argentina were now back in Syria, and they knew him and quickly became friendly. He continued to front as the exporter of fine furniture and was making money like you wouldn't believe while an Israeli agent exporting fine furniture. And he had this lovely, magnificent home, beautifully furnished, and he'd throw these magnificent parties with beautiful women, and he would invite all of the generals of the Syrian general staff and high political personalities. And he met the president of Syria's daughter, who fell madly in love with him. This is an Israeli agent. He would throw these parties at night, and by the time the party was over, all of the discussions that had gone on the Syrian general staff meetings in the morning, he knew about at night. He had one of the most powerful radio transmitters built to that time. And after the party broke up, he would take out this carefully concealed radio transmitter, and he would call back to Israel, and he would tell them everything that took place in the Syrian staff meeting that morning. This guy became very friendly with the chief of staff of the Syrian army. And he said, I'd like to visit the Golan Heights. And so the chief of staff was his very close personal friend. He went to the Golan Heights for weeks. And in front of the generals, he would take out his drawing pads as he traveled along the Golan Heights. And he would sketch in where the minefields were, where the barbed wire was, where the pillboxes were, where the tanks were, where the artillery was. He'd just sketch it in all over the place, in front of them, as he would discuss with them, why are you doing it and so forth. Then one day he said to his friend, he said, you know, he said, the Israelis are not dummies. He said, before they attack, they'll send over observation planes. And they'll see where you've got your pillboxes and your tanks and your troops. And he said, you want to conceal that. Beside that, it gets so hot up here. Your men are in the sunshine. There's no shade for them. Do one thing that'll help you two ways. Plant this particular kind of a tree that grows rapidly and gives a lot of shade. It'll conceal your positions from the air. Makes sense. And it'll also give shade to your troops. It won't be as hot. Good idea. And so they planted these trees. And Eli Cohen simply wired Israel. He says, every time you see one of these trees, there's a Syrian pillbox next to it. Shell the tree. Happened. Then he took these drawings that he had made. He hollowed out the leg of a table, put the drawings inside, sent the table and the chairs to Argentina, wound up in the hands of an Israeli agent. When Israel attacked the Golan Heights in 1967, they knew where everything was because of Eli Cohen. About 3 months later, after the victory, Eli Cohen, still in Syria with a wife and kids in Tel Aviv, was routinely calling home, calling Israel. And the Indian government, the Indian embassy, had been getting interference when she was trying to call India. And so they went to the authorities in Syria and said, something's wrong, we're getting all this interference. They thought something didn't sound right. They got electric technicians or technicians with equipment, and over a period of time they honed in on that signal from three locations, and they finally found out it was in the home of Eli Cohen. Israel said, we've got over 600 Syrian prisoners in our jails. We'll empty the prisons. 600 or so can go. Let us have Eli Cohen back. They said no. They hung him upside down in Damascus Square and left the body there for ridicule and all that was involved. And then Israel said, we'll give you $15 million in farm equipment for his body. And they said no, and they buried the body of Eli Cohen in an unmarked grave somewhere in Damascus, Syria. But he was the unsung hero of the 1967 Six-Day War, and you'll find boulevards all over Israel, Eli Cohen Boulevard. But that's how they captured the whole Golan Heights. Now, the world comes to Israel and says, give up the Golan Heights. And Israel says, you've got to be out of your tree. From 1948 to... Listen, ladies and gentlemen, from 48 to 67, the Syrians were up there. And for 19 years on the mountaintop, all they did was shell the Israeli communities below. You know how Israel took that? They went to these kibbutz and got the soldiers out of those kibbutz. You know, in Israel, everybody's in the army. When you're 18, you're drafted. Men and women. Men and women. Men for 3 years, women for 2 years normally. But you stay in the active reserves till you're 55. Israel is a very small standing army. About 160,000. But they'll mobilize 450,000 in 48 hours. And they keep getting training. Now, they took the men out of the kibbutz right underneath where they were getting shelled. And they said, okay, this is where you live? Is it up there they were shelling you from? You go get them. You know, just like Nehemiah, he had them build it right where they lived. And they took the Israeli soldiers and said, okay, you go attack it. Incidentally, everything was built up there by Russian technicians. Russian technicians told them what to do. If you see some of the pillboxes, if you can visualize, here's the mountaintop and here are the Israelis. Some of the pillboxes, like a third of the way down the mountain, did not have their openings facing toward Israel. They had their openings facing toward the top of the mountain. Russian technicians. The Russians said the Israelis are too smart. They're not going to suicidally simply try to come up this mountain. They'll do two things. They'll try to come up the mountain, but they'll also drop paratroopers on the top to come down. They were right. It's exactly what Israel did. And some of the pillboxes were facing where they knew they would come from, up the top. All right, so in 1967, Israel captured the Golan Heights, this mountain range. Now the world says, give it up. lost thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. It's a natural, defensible border, and the world says, give it up. And Israel says, you're out of your skull. Do you realize there's a law for the world, and there's another law they want for Israel? Everybody else wins things in battles. Nobody says, give it up. In a battle that they didn't want and didn't start. Okay, they won the Golan Heights. They also won Jerusalem and the West Bank. Concerning the West Bank, Israel has said, repeated and repeated, and I had cabinet-level officials say to me, in Israel, the Palestinians can live here, the West Bank. They can live there, they can have their own schools, they can have their own mayors, they can have their own police, they can run everything they want independently, but it's got to be in a Jewish state because we've got to have some outposts there. Because if we simply turn it over to the Palestinians, the PLO, the terrorists, will be there in 6 months right up against our border and put us in an impossible-to-defend position. So they can live there, they can have everything autonomously. The PLO says, we don't want that. We don't even recognize the existence of Israel. And if any of the Palestinians said, we'll do it, the PLO would kill them. People don't realize, you don't get it in the press. Most of the Palestinians hate the PLO. If they would cooperate with Israel, their loved ones would get killed. The Christians at this moment, about 45% in general terms, Christendom, in Lebanon, welcome the Israelis as heroes. But you'll get very little of that in the press today. Because what the PLO was doing and the Syrians, we'll say a little bit about that in a moment. Israel gave up the Sinai back to Egypt. Because Egypt says, we're willing to negotiate a peace. Fine, we'll give you back the Sinai. Now in 1973, Israel went to war again. I must go quickly. In 1973, Israeli agents were told, it was a cold day in October, Israeli agents sent in messages from all over the world saying, you're going to be attacked, you're going to be attacked. It's coming from Egypt again and Syria. They told them the hour, the time, the place, the day. More than 200 separate messages came in. Israeli agents were screaming, and they're coming, it's coming. And the Israeli government, so puffed up with pride after the 1967 war, number one, and worried about world public opinion, number two, said, no, they won't do it this time. They know we'll clobber them. And they did not prepare. It was Yom Kippur, the highest holy day. Egypt came across the Suez Canal with more than 2,200 tanks. And the Bar-Lev line, called after one of the Israeli generals who had designed it, supposed to stop the tanks, had only a skeleton crew, a handful of men. Most of them were home. If you can visualize, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement for Israel, is almost like a combination of our Easter and Christmas combined. They only had a handful of men there. And the Egyptians came across with super sophisticated weapons, with powerful air water hoses that simply knocked down these defenses that the Israelis had put up, thought would stop the tanks. They were caught off guard. On the Golan Heights, the Syrians came over the Golan Heights. Now they were coming up across with more than 1,800 tanks. The Israelis had under 600 men on duty along the whole Golan Heights when that attack took place. Under 600 men, most of them were 18-year-old kids. The Barak division, under 600 men. 90% of the Israeli officers who got to the battlefront in the first week died. 90%. Because in Israel, an officer does not say forward march, he literally says follow me. And here were young kids, 18, 19-year-olds, the regular army, inexperienced, they had never been in battles before, but they know that we need 48 hours to mobilize the army. If we don't have 48 hours, we're done. They were literally throwing their bodies in front of tanks to try to stop them, to give enough time for the army to be mobilized. Now, they look back in hindsight. The initial success of both Egypt and Syria the first 3 days was so amazing. They just moved! They couldn't believe it. Every time they'd come up against Israel before, they got clobbered. Every time they got clobbered. They had they were scared to death about taking on the Israelis. Every time they fought, they lost. And now in 73, they were moving so fast. You know what they did? They stopped. They literally stopped and they said, we're fearful that maybe the Israelis are backing up to draw us into a trap. Furthermore, the Russian tactic was you go forward and then you stop, you consolidate, you bring up reinforcements, you resupply, and then you move on again. If they had kept going, Israel would have been done in 2 days. They would not have had time to mobilize their army. But in the sovereignty of God, as Egypt and Syria pushed on, they stopped. True stories that you simply would not believe. I have personally interviewed the officer who was in charge of the supplying and the refueling, a young man by the name of Zvi Greengold. He was a lieutenant in the Israeli tank corps. He was on furlough, on leave, when the war broke out in October of 1973. He was in civilian clothing. He heard the war had broken out. He hitchhiked, confiscated the vehicle, and got to the front lines. And he asked his commanding officer for a command. They gave him four tanks. He was in civilian clothing. You could be 5 miles away from the front lines in Israel. He got four tanks, and they start up the Golan Heights, this mountain range. And two of the tanks immediately got knocked out, destroyed. His tank backed off on one other tank. They went along the base of the Golan Heights, and he found a narrow ravine that was thought inaccessible. And he was able to get his tank up this inaccessible ravine, up onto the Golan Heights, and he would attack Syrian tanks, and then he would hide. It was all sand dune and mountainous. He would hit and run and hit and run, or he'd hit at night and hide under the concealment of darkness. He would expend all of his fuel and all of his shells. He would come back down again. He would refuel and rearm and go back up again. He fought on for 48 hours, nonstop. At one point, his tank was destroyed. He was able to confiscate another passing-by Israeli tank. He fought on. He was badly burned on the face and the hands. After 48 hours, he came down, fell before his commanding officer. He said, I can do no more. And they document that he knocked out over 60 Syrian tanks. Miracles no less great than the miracles you read about in the Old Testament. But it allowed Israel to hold on until they could mobilize their army. Now what happened is, as these tanks came, Israel thought they had a trump card. Israel's Air Force is considered by our Air Force generals to be the best in the world. The best trained, the best dedicated, and unfortunately the best experienced. Highly motivated. In a dogfight, there's no competition. With the Syrians, the Egyptians, no competition. In this invasion into Lebanon, Israel has now knocked out close to 90 planes and lost only one. And the one it lost was not a dogfight, it was from a SAM-6 ground-to-air missile. Israel thought it would get its planes into the sky and stop the tanks. Thought it could rely on that if nothing else worked. But what happened is the Egyptians and the Syrians had both built SAM-6 and 7 missile sites. Now these were Russian SAM-6 and 7 missile sites, and as they were being built, I want you to understand it, as they were being built, Israel knew they were being built and was bombing them every single day. You may remember the news back then. As these SAM-6 and 7 missile sites were being built, Israel was bombing them. Wouldn't let them get built. They were being built under Russian supervision. Well, the Russians complained to the United States, and Henry Kissinger went to Israel. And he said, look, we're trying to improve relations with the Soviet Union, and they're complaining about your bombing their SAM-6 and 7 missile sites, and they're not going to pose any danger to you. And so under pressure from the U.S., I'm telling you like it is, Israel was forced to stop bombing those SAM-6 and 7 missile sites. So what happened, when Israel now tried to get its planes into the sky to stop the advancing tanks, her planes were getting knocked out of the sky by these SAM-6 and 7 missile sites. It was the Russian tactic of you send your tanks, you send your men, but you keep an umbrella over them of these missile sites so the planes can't get at them. And that's what happened. Things were going so bad the first few days of 1973 for Israel that Moshe Dayan, who was then chief of staff, went to Golda Meir, who was then prime minister, I'm quoting now, he said, he said, the third temple is about to be destroyed. He requested permission to arm their atomic bombs. They came out of storage silos, at least 13 bombs. They went to 5 or 6 different airfields. They were loaded and armed, ready to go if it became absolutely essential. And as Israel brought these atomic bombs out of storage silos, Russian spy satellites saw what Israel was doing. Russia began to load paratroopers onto planes. They had them on the planes to bring over to the Middle East. And rushed nuclear devices by ship to Syria. And as Russia was sending these nuclear devices, our espionage saw what Russia was doing. And that's when former President Nixon called a red alert of our army worldwide. And I can tell you that we had special forces, Green Beret troops, at Lod International Airport with super sophisticated anti-aircraft equipment. I can tell you that our army was alerted worldwide, that our men who are in our intercontinental ballistic missile silos were locked in. That's what was happening. And as that was happening, you'll see the guy dominating the news now from the Middle East, Ariel Sharon, the number two man, the guy who's in charge of this whole Lebanese operation. Number two man in the Israeli cabinet. He was a field general at the time. And without orders from above, that's why a lot of the Israelis didn't like him, because this guy did it on his own. With no orders, he saw an opening. He had his tanks in the Sinai, and he moved his tanks against the advancing Egyptian tanks. The Russians, the Egyptians, they thought that he was going to engage them in pitched battle. Instead of doing that, he took his tanks, and with his tanks, he opened up a wedge, a corridor 10 miles wide in the Sinai. And desperately, he held that corridor open. And as that corridor was kept open, other Israeli tanks went rushing through that open corridor and in a surprise maneuver, crossed the Suez Canal. Fanned out and very quickly knocked out the SAM 6 and 7 missile sites, which Russia had not anticipated. And other Israeli tanks now began to come through that corridor and surrounded the Egyptian Third Army with about 40,000 troops. Completely encircled, completely cut off, with running out of water, running out of food. They could have been massacred. One of the largest tank battles in history took place in the Sinai then. And when it was done, the Egyptian forces were destroyed, and the Third Army was surrounded, and Israel was 48 hours away from destroying Cairo, Egypt. The same time, the battle took a miraculous change on the Golan Heights, because they had held long enough to mobilize their army. And then they drove them back, knocked out the SAM 6 and 7 missile sites, for all practical purpose had defeated the Syrian army and were on their way to Damascus. And within 48 hours, Henry Kissinger, I'm not faulting him, I'm just telling you what happened. He flew from the United States to the Soviet Union, back to New York, and in a matter of hours, the United Nations called for a ceasefire. When Israel was losing, few of the nations of the world opened their mouth. Do you realize that the United Nations is dominated by the Arab nations, the communist nations, and the third world nations? Up until recently, according to our ambassador to the United Nations, the PLO had more influence in the United Nations than the United States does. Within 48 hours, when Israel was losing, nobody said zilch. When the tide of battle miraculously changed, ceasefire! Now, Israel stopped not because the United Nations said ceasefire. Israel stopped because the United States said don't go any further. The reason was quite simple. Russia had invested billions and billions and billions of dollars in the Middle East, Syria, Egypt, and if they let Israel go, she would have destroyed Egypt and Syria. And Russia would have been forced to come into the Middle East. And so to keep Russia out, America put pressure on Israel to go no further. Now you want to understand the mentality. You will understand Israel fought war after war after war and won nothing. And the Israeli mentality, they went into Lebanon before, and America said, look, the world doesn't like it, come on out. Now I have talked to cabinet level officials, and they said no longer, Menachem Begin will not be dictated to by American policy. America is getting as much from Israel as Israel is getting from America. He says, no more dictation. We have fought war after war after war. We've lost men. We've gained nothing. Next time, we're going to go all the way. Nobody's going to stop us. Now, in 1973, Israel then, at the end, won the conflict. Now, will you please understand, 5-6 more minutes, will you please understand that when the Palestinians left Israel in 1948, they went to the West Bank. And there they were living in the West Bank for 19 years. When Israel captured the West Bank in 1967, these Palestinians crossed the Suez Canal into Jordan. From Jordan, they began to launch terrorist acts against Israel regularly. PLO, not all of the Palestinians, but some of the fanatical Palestinians, PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization. They would begin to launch terrorist attacks against Israel by design, never the Israeli military, never the Israeli men. Kill women and children. That was their program. Come across the Jordan River and launch terrorist attacks. Israel says, okay, every time you come across and you kill some of our people and you launch a terrorist attack, we're going to hit you back. You're going to know it. And if you kill 10, we're going to go back and kill 20. Every time you come across, we've got to stop you. The only way we can stop you is you've got to know axiomatically, every time you hit us, you're going to get it back. And the PLO tactic was and is, we put our bases, we put our headquarters, we put our materials in the most populated civilian area. Because contrary to what you might think, Israel probably has the highest regard for human life of any nation on the face of the earth. Hates to see a person die. When one Israeli soldier dies, the whole nation mourns. When civilians in Syria and Jordan and Lebanon die, Israel hates it they die with him. But what are you going to do when the PLO puts its headquarters in Beirut, Lebanon, on the sixth floor of the largest building, in the most crowded area, knowing Israel's hatred of killing civilians, so you can't bomb her from above, you got all these other floors, and you can't even launch a commando attack because you've got to go up six flights to get at them. But there comes a time when the raids are increasing and increasing and increasing, when Israel says, look, we can't just keep enduring this. Cities have been shelled and destroyed and rebuilt and shelled and destroyed and rebuilt. And Israel says, how much? I mean, you don't read about all the shellings that have been going on in North Israel. And Arafat is one of the biggest terrorists the world has ever known. But our press shows him day after day holding a little child. He's been a killer of children for years. By design. And they put their troops and they put their equipment and they put their command posts in the most... He's been playing games. The PLO, he's been defeated. Militarily, he wants a political victory. Get world press. Keep the 6,000 there. Talk about peace. No, you're not going to do it now. But the world press sees what the Israelis are doing. They're killing them. Israel could have gone in one day in the beginning and it would have been all over. But there was pressure from the world. Don't do it. There are too many civilians. And now it's a drawn-out, terrible thing. But do you understand that what happened in 1971, the PLO was down in Jordan. They had crossed from the West Bank into Jordan. And they would hit from Jordan into Israel and go back into Jordan. Israel said to King Hussein, look, you're the ruler, and if you're going to allow them to operate on your territory, whatever happens to your people, it's your fault. King Hussein became concerned they were trying to take over his government, and so he had an army that was large enough, the Arab Legionnaires, they drove the PLO out in what was called Black September. That was Arab against Arab. They drove them out in 1971, September, Black September it was called. They went up into Syria. From Syria, Syria helped them into Lebanon. In Lebanon, you had the most advanced city in the Middle East. Banking capital in the Middle East, beautiful hotels, lovely people, about 45% of them Christian in general terms, 55% Muslim. They had always been at one another's throats because the Christians were more educated, had the better jobs, had the bigger homes. There was friction between the Muslim and the Christian. So the PLO came in and they incited a civil war. You didn't see our newspapers screaming about the thousands of poor Lebanese that were dying because the PLO had caused a civil war. Thousands of them were dying in the civil war between the Muslim and the Christian generally. And while the war was going on, what do you think happens? Here comes Syria over with 30,000 troops. Because Syria always viewed Lebanon as part of greater Syria. Here was an opportunity for them to take over Lebanon. And as they're coming into Lebanon, they want it because they want to come down to the southern part of Lebanon to be able to attack Israel much easier, give Israel another border to worry about. So Israel said to Syria, here's a line in the map. You cross that line, we have war. That stopped the Syrian army, about 30, 35. They're in Lebanon, trying to take over Lebanon, causing problems. So you've got in poor Lebanon. You've got the Muslim fighting the Christian, which the PLO incited. You got the PLO all over Lebanon. You got Syrians who've come in. They wreaked havoc in that nation. Thousands were dying. You didn't read one thing hardly in the newspaper. Not one thing until Israel went into Lebanon. And most of the Lebanese themselves were welcoming Israel as a liberating army. But you're not getting much of that in the newspaper. The PLO has actually been shelling some Christian villages. But you don't get much of that in the newspaper. And Israel stopped the outskirts of Beirut because there are 600, 700, 800,000 people with 6,000 holed up in the middle. So all Israel said is get the PLO out of here. Get them out of here. And the Arab nation said, we don't want them. That's how good they are. None of the Arab nations wanted them. They would foot the bill as long as they were killing Jews because they hated the Jews, but they didn't want them in their countries. Now they've been playing games and playing games and playing games. You realize that Israel is, it's costing her millions of dollars every day. She has got to mobilize her whole army. Maybe 50% of it's up in Lebanon right now. One of our missionaries has a daughter and two sons up there as I speak to you right now. None of them want to be up there. You call them into the army, it means the crops aren't getting picked. The factory is deserted. It's costing Israel millions of dollars. They cannot afford a war of attrition. And that's what they're playing up there. And the nations of the world are condemning Israel. How come the United Nations didn't say, PLO, get out of there? How come the United Nations didn't say, Syrians, 30,000, get... You know why? Because they couldn't get it through the United Nations. Because the communist nations and the Arab nations and the third world nations would vote as a bloc. But Israel, get out of there. And so the press, I don't know why our press, I don't know whether it has to do with official policy, but they're distorting what is really happening in the Middle East. And people do not really have a picture of what is going on. Israel is not always right. Israel does a lot of things that I would disagree with. But she has a right to live within safe and secure borders as every other nation in the world does. She's not picking the fights. She doesn't want the wars. She doesn't want to spend more than 50% of her gross national product on defense. She doesn't want to have an inflation rate that is running more than 100, 140, 150% year after year after year because she has to have a big defense budget. But to survive, she's got to do it. And the world is saying there's a law for the rest of the nations and there's another law for it. Ladies and gentlemen, Israel doesn't want America to make her policy. How would you feel if there were terrorists in Canada who were permitted by the Canadian government to come down and to kill Americans? In a minute, you'd say, get our Marines up there and knock them out. But for Israel, they say, look, there's instability in the oil and Russia wants to come in, so we'll put pressure on Israel. No, my friends, we're simply not getting an accurate picture of what is really going on. God help us to be discerning and to realize that all of these things have prophetic implications, and I believe the hour is late and the need is great, and the gospel is still the power of God unto salvation universally to the Jew, to the Gentile, to the Arab, as well as the Jew. Christ died for them all. Shall we pray? Father, we thank you for this time together. That which is accurate and factual, make it find a response in each of our hearts. And that which is inaccurate, does not reflect the events as they really are, may it find no response in any heart. Accomplish your perfect purpose, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.